Hello and welcome to Nutrigenomics in Clinical Practice. Today's presentation is going to pull together a lot of the things that we've talked about thus far, a lot of the things that are in your module about nutrigenomics that are very clinical, are very technical, that go through SNPs and all that. And today we'll just go in and do a little bit of a review of some of that and then give you some clinical pearls in terms of what do you do with this information, especially if you don't feel like this is this area that you want to really specialize in, that this is the area that you want to really focus and study, because the kind of studying you need to do to become an expert in this is quite profound. And it's like shooting a moving target because it's constantly changing and evolving, because this is a brand new science and a brand new piece of medicine and clinical practice. So before we begin, just make sure everything that we're talking about is not medical advice, it's not diagnosis. Anything that you learn or hear today that you feel like you want to do, make sure that you do it because it's based on your own decisions and in conjunction with whatever practitioner you might be working with for yourself.
What I really wanted to emphasize today is that when you're working with people and you're doing the basics, and you're helping them with their adrenals, and you're doing the food stuff and the exercise, and you're working on their mindset, and they're still like, just don't seem to be making the progress you think they should based on all the stuff that they're doing. Chances are there might be something in their genetic pathways that's hindering them. And knowing this would be really helpful to you. You can get into a big can of worms if you just run the SNPs on everybody and then start to look at, well, what do I do for this SNP and what do I do for that SNP? Because really, number one, you don't know whether those particular SNPs are expressing. And just as a refresher, SNPs are single nucleotide polymorphisms. The lay population will call them genetic defects. They're not necessarily defects, but they're pathways that, because of specific genetics, the enzymes that work those pathways are not working as efficiently as they could. They could be working 40% of optimal. They could be working 25% of optimal. They could be depressed by 40% or 25%. They could be depressed by 80%. It depends on whether the person has two genes that are coding for this polymorphism or one gene coding for the polymorphism. And then there's a group of genes that might code for similar pathways, and it depends on which ones, how many of those are out of balance. Suffice to say, I don't see any that completely shut off a particular pathway. It just depends on how it's coded and what's going on, how much of it, and what other things are happening, how much depression they'll have. So there's not a complete turning off of this particular pathway, which is why when you get back to the basics, the basics, the basics. So, for example, if somebody has a SNP in an area that is caffeine metabolism, and they are slow metabolizers of caffeine, they're slow to clear caffeine from their system, they're going to be very sensitive to the effects of caffeine. Well, if you get somebody off of caffeine, that pathway issue may not cause them a problem. Same thing, there's other SNPs that may cause a problem with acetaminophen or particular drugs. Now, if they don't get exposed to those particular things, having that genetic issue is not going to be problematic for them, right? Environmental stuff. If you have somebody who's living in a really toxic environment and using pesticides and spraying their walls with all kinds of high VOC paints and using air fresheners and using toxic chemicals, to deal with like cosmetics and cleaning solutions, their detox pathways are going to be very stressed. So if on top of having those environmental exposures, they have SNPs that are depressing and decreasing the effectiveness of their detox pathways, that's when they run into problems. Okay? Same thing is true of even just like putting somebody on a cleanse, and you put somebody in a cleanse and they feel horrible instead of great. Now, most people are going to feel so good for the first few days of a cleanse, but usually there's a time after which you just feel like great and you feel great afterwards. But there are people who you try to put them on any kind of cleanse, whether it's just green juices or fasting or even just going from a standard American diet to a whole foods, mostly raw diet, they can have an overabundance of cleansing that their liver just can't keep up with. And when the liver can't keep up with that, then because of genetics or because of like previous high exposure rates, they are going to not feel well. And sometimes people will say, well, I'll just keep going on this. Oh, yeah, I'm still having detox reactions from going on a raw diet, and it's 3 months later. That's not detox reaction. That's toxic reactions. That's your body's just not able to deal with it. And when you get these messages from people, if it's through detox, you need to slow down. But it always goes back to our basics. What's our first rule of a cleansing program? Reduce the toxic load. Reduce the toxic load, right? So that's your job with people, is reduce the toxic load. Incorporate more fresh whole foods into their diet. Now, you have things that might come up because of SNPs that you have a reaction you wouldn't expect, that whenever they increase their greens, they feel worse. And when they decrease their greens, they feel better. That could be related to problem handling sulfur. They can't get rid of the sulfur. It could be a problem with oxalate handling. They can't metabolize oxalates effectively. So these are some of the compounds, chemicals in greens that for most people, there's no problem. But if they have some either genetic or acquired differences in how they handle it, it's going to be an issue.
This is a slide
that I got from Dr. Lynch's seminar that will help us to just, in a nutshell, kind of look at the big picture overview of the various SNPs and to kind of get a sense of, if you're having these problems with people, you have these kind of cases that just are, nothing's happening, they're not getting resolved, that when you start to look at the SNPs, you might be able to hone in on a few key things. But know that if it's too complex, there are people to refer to. So we are looking at ways that we could support people in going through this. Doesn't mean you have to become experts at this, but the fact that you know it exists and you know what some of the highlights are and you can help them, it's not just a matter of testing that they have an MTHFR and thinking, okay, we just have to give them folate, because you can get into trouble that way, because if you give them too much, it can back up some of the other pathways that they have. Reminder, single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, SNPs for short. It's just all the base pairs. And a single, if you look at your DNA, there's a matter of nucleotides, C, T, A, and G, cytosine, thymine, adenosine, and guanine. And pairs, the DNAs are paired. Your two strands are paired, one strand from mom, one strand from dad. The two come together, and you'll have these particular pairs, the base pairs. And they're usually going to be, you know, a G and a G come together, an A come together, a T and a T, because they're supposed to be identical. Now, if where there's supposed to be a T in mom's pair, there's a G, that would be a T and a G. And I'm getting this wrong because T's and G's don't go together. But if you get a T and a G, just bear with me, then that's saying there's a polymorphism there. You have a heterozygous polymorphism because one of them, which should be a T, is now a G. If both of them that should be T's are both G's, then you have a homozygous polymorphism. Both mom and dad gave you a bum gene, and it's not going to work as effectively. Okay, heterozygous polymorphisms generally tend to decrease the effectiveness of that pathway by about anywhere from 25% to 40%, whereas homozygous polymorphisms will tend to reduce the effectiveness of that pathway by somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% to 80%. So that's a review of what the SNPs are. Nutrigenomics, right, is the study of how what we eat and how we live our lives, foods and nutrients, and I think of nutrition as more than just food and nutrients, it's like the environment and all the other things that come in, how that affects the gene expression and how you can modify and adapt your food and your environment so that it works right. 23andMe, as you recall, there's a lot of confusion about 23andMe. People are saying, oh, they took it off the market, you can't do 23andMe anymore. Not true. You can do 23andMe, you just won't get the 23andMe interpretation of your data saying, oh, you have a 20% increased risk of heart disease, you have a 30% increased risk of this, you have a 10% increased risk of that. The FDA said, no, you can't do that until, you know, you jump through our hoops to prove that this, you know, is based on science. We weren't using that anyway, just quite frankly. What we were doing is going to the raw data piece, downloading the raw data, and then using different filters to help us to see what those different raw data pieces meaning. What I mean by that is raw data would be there's like 12 MTHFR genes. I'm just making that up. There's some large number of them. And of those, you've got these particular ones are the most studied ones, and these you have this particular problem with it or it's just fine. And there's a bunch of different genes like that, and I'll show you more about that in a bit. So basically, you still have access. 23andMe is still a very valuable tool for you to use. If you haven't done it on yourself already, I highly recommend that you do. If you haven't done it on family members, and if you use my link, we're passing on our 20% discount. So rather than me giving you an affiliate link, which I could, and I can make money every time you do a test, instead I'm giving you a link where I get 20% off, and you just can get that. So you can, for $80 a test, you can run that.
Since they had the FDA thing, they started using a new chip, and there are substantially less SNPs overall that are available in the raw data, and relative to the SNPs that were previously available, for instance, through LiveWello or MTHFR support, there's 83 of those that are not available. They're just not testing them on the relative to methylation. These 83 that they've taken out are, you know, in some cases significant. There are some like BHMT, SHMT. There's a whole bunch of glutathione like the GSTM1. There's only one SNP reported there. Some of the IgE SNPs, some of the clotting factors, AHCY relative to homocysteine, BHMT. There's a CBS one that's not reported. One of the DAOs, one of the folate 3 receptors, some of the GAD receptors. MAT1 is 1A is not reported. Some of the MTHFR, some of the MTRRs, NOS, some of those. Like I said, SHMT, SLC, 19A1. So in any case, there's a lot. And a lot of the mitochondrial SNPs are missing. It's going to be even more important to be doing follow-up lab testing in certain areas. Like, for instance, nitric oxide. You know, you can't depend on the expression of any of these. These are just signposts, right? So it makes it more important to do the lab testing to see what's actually expressing in certain ones of these. Nitric oxide would be a good example of that.
This is basically the overview of all the different SNPs that could be important clinically. And basically just want you to see this picture to see this is complex, and it's not just a matter of, okay, you've got an MTHFR SNP, let's just give you some methylfolate. First of all, you want to get people eating uncooked leafy greens, which is the best source of folate. But if they are, there's still other problems. They may have problems with folate receptors. So even if they're eating tons of leafy greens or taking tons of folate, there's going to be some issues and they have to take higher amounts. So it's going to be very variable. There's this connection between the folate pathways and the neurotransmitter pathways, the COMT in particular. And if you push too much folate, you can give people symptoms. So it's a matter of having an overview understanding. And there's a lot of people out there who are claiming, oh, yeah, my doctor tested me for MTHFR and I had a problem with it, so I'm taking 5,000 milligrams of methylfolate now. And that might be fine for some people. And for other people, that's not okay because they're going to feel really bad, because that's going to cause backup of some of their other pathways.
So I just want you to get the sense that there's a lot of complications in these pathways, and you can't just throw in some B12 and throw in some folate. So that's what the consensus is in more of the people that aren't quite educated but know a little bit about it is, we have this MTHFR thing, they're testing their patients for it, and then they're just throwing methyl B12 and methyl folate at them. There was one company that's making one that's 15 milligrams of methyl folate in one capsule. And I really believe it's important to just do single nutrients at a time, small doses, and just gradually build them up. If you come to the point where you realize that they need, you know, a certain amount of each one, and then you want to put them on a combined formula, but I think when you're first working with people, it's really important to just do that individually. I do that with herbs as well. We'll work with a particular tincture, and then if we get to the point where we find a formula that works for them, and we feel like they're going to be on it for several months, then we'll say, okay, you can use this, get this combination. That makes compliance a little bit harder, right? If you've got people who are not, well, I want to take five different things. You got to really be really good at building the rapport with people and explaining to them the complexities of this. And when I do that with people, they're more apt to say, okay, yeah, I don't want to get into that trouble. And I say, look, if you just buy this formula, and yes, it's less expensive to buy the formula in the short run, and yes, it's easier to just take one capsule or one dropper full or whatever in the short run, in the long run, it could end up costing you a lot more money, because if you take this formula and it has five ingredients in it, and you're reacting to one ingredient, you've just blown the entire cost of that whole thing because you can't take it. Whereas if we just work with each individual nutrient and we increase it. So again, getting back to how do you work with people when they have these issues, you have to start with the basics. You have to make sure that their diet is and their lifestyle is not stressing the pathways, not putting a lot of chemicals and things that the liver has to then go through, and methylate and acetylate and all that glucuronidate and all those other things. You put things in that are safe and sound. So you're really working with people on sometimes even getting the genetic testing to help use it as an inspiration or a stimulation for people to say, look, you know, this is why you can't smoke and drink and go out with your friends and, you know, just eat junk food and expect to be well. Maybe they can. They may have a different genetics, but with your genetics, you've got to be really careful. And when you're really careful, magical things can happen. Years before the genomics whole research project even got started, I just made an assumption when I was in my 20s based on the health issues I'd had up till that point that I probably have really crappy genetics. There's no old people in my family. People get sick and they get all these things. I'm just going to assume I have really bad genetics, and I'm not taking my chances. I'm not going to say, well, for now I'll have pizza, and, you know, it's okay if I use that hairspray, you know, a couple of times a week instead of every day just to keep my hair looking, or whatever. I just decided I'm going pure. And when I finally did get my genetics, I'm just so grateful that I made that decision because my genetics are not so hot. I've got some pretty significant issues. I've got a double heterozygous MTHFR, I've got some MTRRs, I've got some problems with glutathione, I've got some problems with some of the, I think it's the caffeine metabolism, I've got problems with a lot of these pathways. When I say problems, I mean I have SNPs in those pathways. And it's possible that because of the diet and lifestyle choices I've made, that I've just not activated those SNPs. And it's also possible that for the ones that maybe were already activated or maybe still activated, I just don't stress those pathways. So it goes back to really reinforcing with your people that you're working with the importance of the basics and whatever it takes to get them convinced. Like for some people, they'll say, I say, I think you have a gluten problem. You've got these Hashimoto's antibodies, and we could test gluten, but, you know, I would just say, if you don't want to spend the money, just assume. And they'll go, yeah, I'm not going to do it. And other people will go, well, you got to prove it to me, so I got to get the testing done, right? So everybody you work with is going to be different, and you've got to use whatever you can, whatever tools you can, to motivate and inspire them to take the actions that they need to take. So if the motivating them and inspiring them means getting them to do a test, which you don't feel you necessarily need to make a clinical assessment, but you feel like you need it to help convince them, then that's what you use it for. And you'll be surprised at what people will do when they actually see in black and white what's going on versus when they don't see it in black and white.
So with diet, the motto is subtract then add. With supplements, the motto would be add one at a time to catch any reactions and avoid sensitivity. One at a time, start slow, titrate as needed. What you want to do with supplements is to give people as little as they need, but as much as they need. So the smallest effective dose would be the rule. So you give them a dose, and you see how they react. And you're not seeing any response, and no negative response or positive response, then you move it up. If you give them a dose and you see a little bit of a response but no negative response, then that's good. Then you gradually just build it up. If you start to see that they have a negative response, even if you don't feel like they're having their full therapeutic positive response, you back up to where the level where they didn't have the negative response. And then you keep them there for a while. And then maybe a little bit down the road, a week or two, a month, whatever you deem possible for this person, then you might inch it up a little bit more. You have to give the body the opportunity to adjust, but you also have to give the body the opportunity to react. So if you add a supplement in the morning and you add another one that night and the next day they have reactions, you don't know which one it was. It's not necessarily the last one that you added. It could be the first one and it's a delayed reaction. Same thing when you're doing food sensitivities, and the same kind of rules apply when you're testing for food sensitivity reactions. You don't just add back in five foods from one at a time and slowly. You could start with as low as 100 micrograms. If you're doing the liquids, which I like the liquids best because they get absorbed the best, you would just titrate that down. So if it's 2,000 micrograms per drop or 1,000 micrograms per drop, you then just put it in an empty bottle, put the water in, titrate it down, and just have them try one single drop dose and gradually build it up. The person that I was talking to felt like she just was willing to try it at the full one drop dose, and she did, and she had phenomenal results. Okay, I have other people who take teeny tiny doses, and you would think, how could somebody get a reaction to that? And they have very positive reactions. So it's the smallest effective therapeutic dose that you'd want to be working with. When you look at these pathways, you see they're all intertwined in some way. So the reason I wanted to show you this picture is that if you make a change in one of these cycles, it's going to affect another one that it's attached to. And you make a change there, it's going to affect another one that it's attached to. And you've got to be kind of aware so that if you give somebody something that you think is going to have tremendous effects based on their symptoms, based on other things that you're judging, and they don't, then pulling out a pathway like this can be helpful. One of the things I did that was very helpful for one of my clients, we just sat and we took her SNP report and we just highlighted on this picture. We went and we put red next to the ones that were heterozygous. We put yellow next to the ones that were homozygous. I mean, opposite, heterozygous yellow and homozygous red, and then green next to the ones where they didn't have a SNP issue. And then we looked at all the places where she could be having problems, and it's like, whoa. And then, okay, what are the symptoms that are occurring? Where do we start? Right, how do we start? Because we'd already done all the basics with her. We'd already done all of the diet and lifestyle, and she's doing a lot of things and is still having issues. And once we did that, we just identified one or two places to shift a little bit. And for the last 4 or 5 weeks, she's feeling better than ever. She still has a long way to go. We're still trying to deal with an issue of no matter what she doesn't lose weight. But I think part of it is she still has mercury in her teeth, and we're looking at getting that resolved. So she's still got some of those environmental stressors. But when we broke this down and could see the big picture, so it's a time-consuming process, but start with your own. Just take this picture and take your printout from, say, mthfrsupport.com, and then just go and mark this picture up. It's really amazing. Start with mapping some of these things out. It's not a this for that thing. And that's what I want you to get out of. In general, in any of the things that we're doing, it's not a this for that. This for that is allopathic. Allopathic is you have this symptom, you give this drug. And a lot of people try to approach nutrition and herbal medicine in an allopathic way. What herbs would I give somebody with depression? Well, it depends on the type of depression they have, right? It's like, okay, what kind of migraines do you have? What kind of constipation do you have? And there's all these different pieces of it. Herbalism is not allopathic. It's not a this for that. There may be groups of things that seem to do well for specific symptoms, but it's not going to be an across-the-board thing. And it's the same thing true of nutrients and SNPs. You know, you can't just say, well, yeah, give 500 milligrams of this particular nutrient. When you're working with very sick people, which is what you'll be working with when you're really looking at these pathways, you're looking at people who have had chronic stuff and they've done a lot of the basics and they're not getting the results, you're going to assume that their body is not able to activate the nutrients as well as it could. So therefore, as much as possible, you give the activated form. And the activated forms would be pyridoxal 5-phosphate is the activated B6. You know, methylfolate would be the activated folate, or folinic acid, which is a little further down but not fully activated. Same thing with the B12. You don't want to give cyanocobalamin. You want to give either methyl if they can tolerate it, but you're safer if you go with hydroxy. There's certain times with adenosyl. Had a recent issue with somebody, and we started really tearing her stuff apart and the kind of reaction she was getting. And you know, kind of play detective and say, well, certain foods would create a positive reaction for her. Like, okay, what could be in those foods? How can we find it? Because they were not desirable foods. Like one was bacon, the other was grits. Like, what are some of the things that are in there that could be problematic? We isolated, I don't know how we got down to this, but we got down to certain amino acids, and then we started exploring those amino acids, certain branched chain amino acids, came down to this whole thing with adenosyl cobalamin and certain issues with that, and she does have some of these SNPs. So we're starting her now on adenosyl B12. And, you know, to explain the whole logic behind how we got there would take a while, but that's the thing, is when you kind of don't maybe have these pathways memorized, but you have a cheat sheet like this and you could start to look and you start to say, okay, what is it that makes a person feel better? What is it that makes a person feel worse? And what are some of the possibilities that they could be getting and deriving from that food that helps? So for sulfur, best way to determine without actually labs would be to see if they tolerate sulfur-containing foods. If they have gas that smells like sulfur. So if you find people that you say, yeah, eat some garlic and take MSM and eat a lot of broccoli and brassica vegetables, and they say, I can't, I get gassy, and I have, you know, this really, like, my poop and my gas smell like rotten eggs, then, woo, that could be that they're not processing sulfur appropriately, and they may have some backups in the CBS pathway. That's the one, if you go all the way to the right, the top pathway, it leads down into the transsulfation pathway, CBS enzyme problem. A lot of what we do is really listen. Listen and ask questions. Listen and ask questions. And if the thing you learn the most out of this program is how to ask questions and then how to go back to biochemistry charts, how do these answers to these questions fit in? Where could they be broken? Before you address an MTHFR, before you have somebody who just says, oh, I just did the SpectraCell MTHFR and I have MTHFR problems, so therefore I'm doing this, is you want to address the foundational diet and lifestyle. Get them on leafy greens and gradually increase their amounts of leafy greens. And if they say, well, I usually have problems when I do green smoothies or leafy greens, then you want to find that level where they tolerate it, because part of the problem could be that, number one, it could be that they're getting too much folic acid in that process and it's pushing too much methyl group into some of the other cycles. It could be that. It could be that they have a sulfur problem. It could be that they have an oxalate problem. Remove all folic acid. What do I mean by that? All synthetic folic acid. Everybody that you work with, make sure that they go through all their multivitamins and all their detox powders and all their fancy stuff. A lot of people are on these things that they're being promoted through multi-level marketing as these great detox formulas. And it turns out they got a lot of synthetic vitamins in them. So even some of the stuff like Metagenics, you've got to be careful, because they've still got some formulas that have folic acid in them. So really being careful about that and get all their folic acid out, because that causes a backup in the pathway. Improving their B12 status, especially if you don't know more, starting with hydroxy B12 to be safe. Test their homocysteine levels to see if they've got
a backup in that pathway or possibly an accelerated CVS pathway. Reducing oxidative stress, that goes back to foundational lifestyle stuff, but where would they have oxidative stress? Are they heating oils? Are they eating processed foods, even processed so-called health foods that have oxidized fats in them? Are they really stressed out? Are their adrenals stressed out? The adrenals produce so many oxidative byproducts. So really working on our basics, evaluate their thyroid, and then addressing mitochondrial dysfunction. Because if they've got mitochondrial dysfunction, and if their mitochondria are not functioning properly, they can be having a problem. One of the things that helps people when you're working with an MTHFR before you do the folate is to gradually build up on their B2, riboflavin, okay? And sometimes niacin. Well, niacin can be a double-edged sword, but those are important in mitochondria, you know, FAD and NAD. Okay, there's a lot of things in there, making sure they have enough amino acids to be able to get through that the mitochondria pathway and also to be able to go through the detox pathway. So these are all really important things. Before you just see their, oh, I have an MTHFR, let's take all these things. The foundational stuff is critical, really, really critical. The patches, that's another piece. There's so many places, so many people that are promoting these patches because I know that some of them will say folic acid as methylfolate. What's the form of folic acid that you've put in here? And I'm not going to ask them, is it synthetic or is it real? Is it non-synthetic? Because a lot of times they'll say, oh, of course it's not synthetic. But you got to ask them, what's the source? What is it? What is it? Is it this or is it that? Because sometimes they just don't know enough to know that saying folic acid is a detriment, that people are becoming aware that synthetic folic acid is a problem. And I know people have had good response with patches. Actually, I think the ones my son had didn't have it. Years ago, my son had an issue with B12, and he was actually, it was when he was in puberty, and he was having some issues with paranoia and tingling in his feet and all this. I said, you have a B12 deficiency. We tested him, and sure enough, he did, and he didn't want to take any supplements. We finally convinced him to do the patch, and that was before the patches with the methyl came out or before they were widely available. I didn't find them, but it had cyano, and I said, we'll try it anyway. And he had such a phenomenal response, even with the cyano, but it did not have folic acid in it. That was just cyanocobalamin. And he had a phenomenal response to it. So everything is not black and white, right? Now he takes a folate sublingual. He's smart. And he gets to the point where he'll say, I'm starting to feel a little depressed. I'm going to think maybe my B12 deficiency is coming back. He'll take it for a few weeks. He'll feel better. And so he's found something that works for him. But you've got to work with people to find out what works for them. And that's with methyl folate. He won't let me do his genetic testing, so I don't really know. I don't want to know my genetics. I'm just going to do the best I can. I don't want to be freaked out and paranoid. And if you're working with somebody and they say, I don't want to know that, I don't want to know what my genetics are because I'll just be freaked out that someday I may get Alzheimer's because I have this tendency, then don't test them. Like, he's one of those kids that just, I wouldn't. He said no, and I said, I respected that. But these are some of the things to really keep in mind. And if you're not into this is complicated stuff, and you may not be want to do this. You just want to do more of the basic stuff. But when you know that this is available and your basic stuff isn't working, then you can refer the person on to someone who's got more experience with it, right? And it doesn't mean you get rid of the patient and you're like, you're losing a patient. You're just saying, okay, I want you to consult with this other practitioner to help get, some understanding of these pathways and what our next step would be. You can still hold on to them and help manage the case. So don't feel bad about referring people. So this is just on client motivation, right? Do people say, it's too hard to eat organic food, and it's too hard to exercise, and it's too hard to take all these supplements. And, it's basically the doctors ask him, what fits your busy schedule better, exercising an hour a day or being dead 24? I love that concept. It's true. People say, I don't have time for that. You don't have time not to do it. Look at what it's causing you in your health. Look at what's causing you. So this is important stuff, and this is just to lighten it up a bit. I'd seen this slide. This diet basics, it's all the same stuff we've talked about for a long time. Make sure you get them off the gluten, the dairy, organic. A lot of these SNPs make it challenging for them to handle the gluten and the dairy and sugars and all the processed foods and the pesticides and all. So get them on as clean a diet as you can with lots of organic veggies to their tolerance. Some people may have, like I said, sulfur and oxalate. You got to address those things. But as much of that as you can possibly get them to eat on processed fatty acid balance, hugely important for maintaining all the inflammation and keeping it down, and anti-inflammatory foods. You've got all these resources for doing this. Local homegrown stuff as much as possible. Home-prepared meals versus all the processed stuff. You don't know what's in your food when you eat at a restaurant, and you can hope for the best and hope that they're telling you the truth. And I don't want you to be paranoid and tell people they never can eat in restaurants, but as much as possible, eat at home. And, of course, elimination diets, food allergy testing is critical. It's critical for this stuff. So the basics, we've been talking all along. Get the basics handled before you jump in. Look for horses when you hear hoofbeats, not zebras. And then when you've ruled out horses, then you start to look for the zebras. The steps to restoring balance, taken from Ben Lynch's recommendations with a few of my own, just kind of and reordered in my own order, is basically understand what their goals are. When people have a goal that they want to be vibrantly healthy so that they can play with their grandchildren and take them to Disneyland next year, you keep coming back to that, okay? Is the chocolate cake getting you closer to having the energy you need to take your kids to Disneyland next year? Okay, how can we refocus? How can we reframe this? Of course, detailed health history, looking at environment, lifestyle, diet, getting the gut clean, getting their blood sugar under control, getting their adrenals handled, not just from the standpoint of giving them adaptogens and P5P and B5 and all the nutrients, but getting their adrenals handled from the standpoint of breathing and appreciation, shifting from sympathetic to parasympathetic. Someone interviewed me for her telesummit, and her telesummit is called Yogify Your Business. Kind of a weird name for a telesummit, but the point is to help people learn to bring into their business world the whole aspects of breathing and appreciation and yoga and movement and the whole importance. So we had a conversation about breath and some of the biochemistry of breath. And I had the idea as I was talking to her to create a vital talk on the physiology and biochemistry of breath and what the deep breathing does. And that's all the heart math stuff we've been talking all along. If you get somebody who's willing to do the foods and take elixirs, but they're not willing to take time out for breathing and appreciation and shifting from sympathetic to parasympathetic, then this stuff is just not going to get better. And looking at thyroid, mitochondria, detoxification, pathogens, cell membrane integrity, neurotransmission, methylation, SNPs. So methylation and SNPs are towards the end of this. You're looking at balancing everything. That's why we're doing this at the end of the program. We didn't do this at the beginning of the program. This is for when all the other stuff isn't working and you need some additional things to move into. The more we can make people aware, like the whole folic acid thing is huge. And if you can get your clients aware that folic acid and to question the supplement companies, and the more they start hearing it, the more they're going to make an effort to switch this out. But in the meantime, just start there. With the supplements, right? You look at what supplements people are taking. This is hugely important, and I don't know if I emphasized this enough when we were doing our history taking, is to a lot of people come in and they're on every supplement that they've ever heard makes sense for whatever they've ever experienced. And a lot of times they interact with each other. A lot of times the quality of the supplements is not that good, and there's things in them. You know, you have somebody who has blood sugar issues and they're taking a bunch of supplements with rice flour in them. It could be affecting their blood sugar. You have people, a lot of the things have sodium caseinate in them. There's a lot of things that have, which is dairy, right? It's casein is dairy. So there's a lot of things in these supplements that could be hurting them. So really, a big thing when you're first working with somebody is to have them do the complete list of their supplements, either give you the link to the web page that has all the ingredients listed, or if they can list them out for you, so you can help them to clean up their supplement deck. A lot of people are really attached to their supplements, right? They're just totally attached. And for you to say, oh, God, these supplements are all bad, get off of all of them, they're a little reticent. So you start to explain to them and you start to talk to them and you start to work with them and get the stuff out. Get the folic acid out right away. Get anything out that has hydrogenated oils and talc. Those are usually the stuff that people may know better not to take. But if they're just going down to their Walgreens and buying Walgreens super antioxidant formula. They're probably getting a lot of crap. And even Mike had a cold, a cough going on, and I said, go to the store. He goes, well, the only store I have access to right now is Walmart because it's a walking distance. I said, well, let's see what they have. And he goes in there, and he's like reading the labels, and he calls me up because I can't take this stuff. The vitamin C has blah, 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 blah. This has that. He goes, this is garbage. He's 19 years old. He's able to distinguish between the crap that's sold at the Walmarts versus the stuff he's used to. But even the stuff at Whole Foods, he and I went then together when I went out to visit him shortly after that, and we went to the Whole Foods, and I was like, half of the stuff in there, I didn't want to buy him. You know, I'd say, okay, this is a compromise. It's got mostly good stuff. But I ended up going on Emerson Ecologics later and ordering him a bunch of stuff and having it shipped to him. So really be careful about the stuff. Gaia is usually a good place to get stuff from. Herb Farm is a good, and there's a few of them that sell at the health food stores that are clean and decent, but a lot of them aren't, and you have to be really, really discerning and careful and help your clients to be discerning and careful. And sometimes just simple things like that, you can clean up their act a lot that gets them a lot of significant improvements.
Okay, and then you can maybe talk about how it's important to have good stomach acid for this little sip in between. Right? It's important to have your B12 for this area over here. It's important to eat your leafy greens and not take folic acid to enhance this organic green cycle. Right? It's important to have good estrogen metabolism and something like making sure that they're eating whole foods that have their B vitamins and that they have clean intake and good stomach acid for getting amino acids so that that supports good neurotransmission and the brassicas that help with the estrogen metabolism. Those might be some simplification things. And then the ATP energy cycle, right? We talked about, you know, the B vitamins are so important there, and having good antioxidant status is good there. And, you know, just you can simplify this down a little bit. Like the detoxification pathways, okay? Not only, that's the reduce the toxic load piece, right? Making sure that you've got you're getting, again, your proteins, your amino acids, your B vitamins, and that you're not taking a whole bunch of extra supplements that could throw off balance, that you're really focusing on whole foods that don't have a lot of these oxidation byproducts in them. So if you can incorporate it, but this is the simplified version of it. What would be helpful is for you to look at, okay, how do I simplify this down so it makes sense to me? And then it could make sense to them. We've spent so much time understanding the biochemistry, and of course, you know, I don't have all the answers, but I have enough of the background, and that's hopefully you've gotten to that point where you can pull out your biochemical pathways and go, okay, this is happening. Like somebody, this one I haven't spent the time to figure out yet, but I thought B2 was going to be helpful for her. It showed up on her organic acids that she needed it. It showed up on some of her methylation things, made me think that she would be helped by B2, and she took B2 and she went into a tailspin, and she stopped it, you know, she went back off of it, and then she tried it again in a very, very minute dose. A few weeks later, it sent her into a tailspin. So it's like, okay, why? What could be backed up that the adding the B2 is increasing that pathway, but then it's causing another pathway to get overstimulated, and there's something stuck further down? And that's how you have to think about things. Like if giving a particular nutrient causes them to have a problem, it's probably because giving that nutrient increased the pathway that was blocked, but then something further downstream from it is not blocked. And it's not always going to be that simple answer. But, you know, I feel really confident that you guys have enough that you can do better in helping people with complex problems and energy problems and various things than most MDs out there. I had somebody recently who came through with an issue that all of you would have caught. All of you would have caught when she first started tracking this down. And two top big name, nationally recognized holistic practitioners, and I won't name names, missed this. This poor woman, 4 years of struggling with stuff, she had Hashimoto. She has antibodies. Nobody tested her for it. She has T3 conversion, T4 to T3 conversion issues. But nobody ever picked it up, even though it was point clear on her stuff. Even though she had never had antibodies tested, but her TSH, they wondered why her TSH was jumping up and down over the course of weeks to months. That's Hashimoto. I mean, but you guys, maybe if you didn't really make that connection, that the up and down on TSH fluctuating so much is a sign that it's probably antibodies, you guys would have tested for antibodies, because that's what you know to do on somebody who presents this way. You know that you do a complete thyroid panel and you do Hashimoto's testing, and you do, you know, antibody testing, and you do the look for the conversion issues, high free T4, low free T3. You know to look for those things, or high total T4 and low free T3. You know to look for those things. You've been taught to look for things. Maybe it's not on the forefront of your brain right now, but you're going to find that as you're going through and working with people, you're going to say, oh, I remember this, but I don't quite remember it. And you're going to go to the thyroid module, and you're going to look at the thyroid interpretation. You've got that beautiful handout. It's just a matter of practice. You know, the fog is going to lift as you start to do it. I mean, it's hard to pull things out of, like, this theoretical construct. Even though we've had a lot of case studies, they weren't your own case studies. This is why I have you, as part of certification, do a number of case studies. Because as you go through it, it's going to start to cement. I spoke to just how valuable to actually do the case study and review, like, okay, this is what's happening with this person. Review the notes, review the pathways, review how to interpret the lab, and really make it make sense. So you guys are going to be at the forefront of being able to do this. There's not a lot of health coaches out there that can do this level of work. There's not a lot of MDs out there that do this level of work. Okay? It's just going to take more and more immersion and having it fall into place. Okay? So you're good. You're on track. The more you do it, the better you'll get. And the more we can develop these kinds of tools. Like, what I would love to have is this community, you know, everybody that wants to just continue on, that we create resources for each other that each other can use and give each other permission to use them. Maybe you decide you're going to create this wonderful handout to give people on this, that, or the other thing. That's getting back to the certification. That's why I created, as part of certification, took a little presentation and a handout that you could use, that you would want as part of your library of what you'd share with your clients. And if everybody does that, we have a collection. And the more people that start to go through this certification, the more that bank fills up, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel. I've created lots of this, and I'm sharing it all. But you guys are going to create more that, oh, this works better for me. What about this? Love using these little, like, cool names for the different pathways. It helps people to remember. Right? Waste management, yeah, that's a lot better than transsulfation pathway, right? Feeling good pathway, that's a lot better than the, you know, catecholaminomethyltransferase pathway, right? It's much easier to remember that way. And when you can put pictures to it, it makes all the difference in the world. So we need to do things wisely, and we need to avoid using the D word and the C word, diagnose and cure. Okay, and the T word, diagnose, treat, and cure. Okay, I get a little bit irritated when I see people putting out books like The Hormone Cure. Like, there's really no cure of restoring balance. And I think that puts you at risk when you start to talk about cures and that you're treating people and that, and healing even, using the word healer. I just think that you are a coach, you're an educator, you're a nutrition practitioner, you can even be a nutritionist. You know, when you use those words, that is taking away, well, a nutritionist doesn't diagnose anything. And I think that sometimes, even if you're handing people a, like, here's your recommended stuff to do, that can get kind of iffy, right? Take that as, so you can have people take notes. So you can give people a format and say, okay, I want you to write this down. And I want you to send that to me afterwards, and I'll confirm if you got it right. We're here to help people, and we have the ability to change lives. We already have, right? You know you already have. You know that there's a lot of people that you may not even know how you've changed your lives, but just some of the comments you made as you helped them fill their grocery cart at the store, standing in line at the store, we've already changed lots of lives, helped lots of lives. And we want to continue to do that. And yes, we have to be careful, and yes, we also have to believe that it's all for the best good. You can't get in trouble by calling yourself a health coach. Really. nutrition coach, health coach. You're a sophisticated health coach. That's what we're training you to be. You're not just your ordinary, run-of-the-mill health coach. You understand the biochemistry, the physiology, how the labs work, what labs are necessary and important. And you can do that as a nutritionist or as a health coach. You take the food part seriously. I mean, there's a lot of great functional medicine practitioners out there. They just don't integrate the food as much as we do. And I'm shocked at how they don't really get the labs as much. And I'm shocked at how many people don't test thyroid antibodies and don't know that if you have thyroid antibodies, you got to be off of gluten, not 80%, 90%, or 99.9%, but 100% if you want people to heal. That's my belief, and I stand with it. And I'll tell you, Datis Karazian, that's his standpoint. He does the whole thyroid autoimmune stuff. And when I first went to a class of his, and I took, I remember what it was, adrenal class or something, some other class. And he talked about gluten, and he said, yeah, it could be helpful for people. I said, I don't think it just could be helpful. I think it's really necessary for people with these kinds of problems to get off of it. And I've read this and I've read that. And he's like, yeah, well, for the most part, you know, and he wasn't committing. Then I went back a few years later when I first took his thyroid class, his three-day thyroid class. He was to the point where he said, if I have somebody come to me, and I test them and they have antibodies, I tell them, if you're not willing to get rid of gluten, I'm not willing to be your doctor. I won't help you because I like to be successful, and if you don't get off of gluten, you won't be successful. And he served gluten-free snacks at his event, and I was impressed. So he made that turnaround. Tom O'Brien found out the hard way for himself. Teaches all the stuff, has been doing it for many years about gluten. Found out he had brain antibodies just because he just wanted to test out the new C-Rex antibody panel. Found out he had three brain antibodies. And he went 100% gluten-free because when I asked him, well, weren't you already gluten-free, Tom? He said, almost. And he laughed. He said, that's when I really got that 100% is important. He goes, and even if you don't already have an illness, just do it. Just go off it. Don't play with it. Because that's what he did. Occasionally he'd be out and he'd have something with gluten in it, no big deal. And it was a big deal. And we went 100% gluten-free and he healed his gut. The antibodies to his brain went away. He might not have known that if he didn't do that routine test until he started to develop some memory loss and some signs of Alzheimer's or some twitches or signs of Parkinson's or other things. So I think we do the best work we can when we can get people off of gluten. And I think dairy goes with it because dairy, in addition to other problems, is cross-reacts to gluten in 90% of the people. And we just get them to eat as clean. Eat like your life depends on it. It does. Nothing tastes as good as healthy feels. Nothing. And the more you can help your people to see that, they'll be like one of my clients who came back to me and just said, you ruined Cheetos for me. I can't even think about eating a Cheeto when I go to my friend's house in these parties anymore because all I can start thinking about is all those fat pathways and hormone pathways and all the stuff you taught me about how it screws me up because I can't even think about it. Help them to make the choice. You can do it. You have the tools. We'll keep helping you get more and more tools. The more experience you get, the more you work with people, the more you get help with working with people, where you're working with people and you get a tough case and you can bring it and say, hey, I got a tough case. What's going on with this person? And you can get other eyes and ears on the problem and other experience on the problem. Never, ever, ever stop learning. I'm looking forward to the day when we have one of those Star Trek kind of pieces of equipment where we scan people and we know exactly what's going on biochemically with them. But until then, we do have a lot of tools.